Hello there, folks, and welcome to Christ in Every Word, a podcast of the Concordia Bible Institute, housed on the beautiful campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. This is your opportunity to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest the sacred scriptures with Dr. John Seleska, Director Emeritus of the Concordia Bible Institute, and me, Dr. Brian Gurman, Assistant Professor of Theology here at the university and the current Director of the Bible Institute. Dr. Seleska has had a long career as a parish pastor, college and seminary professor, and he's known for highlighting how central the Christ is throughout the entire Bible, both Old and New Testaments. So it's an honor to be with him here in the podcast room, and it really is an honor. I say that all the time, but it really is to sit here and learn from him a little bit more about the book of 2 Samuel. So, right. Dr. Seleska, yes. Where did we end off last time?
I think we finished chapter 13, and we'll review a little bit of it to set the stage for this chapter 14. What's happening at this point in David's life, the Messianic king, again, is experiencing quite a few difficulties in his own family simply because of that horrendous sin of murder of Uriah the Hittite and then the adultery with his wife Bathsheba. And when Nathan said, the sword is not going to depart from your own family, that's going to begin to happen. And that he actually predicted also that the wives of David would be, that one of his own children would violate his wives in public. He did this in secret, but that would happen in full view of other people, in the sun, it says, outdoors, where everybody could see what was happening. So we see that beginning to happen. Chapter 13, then, had to do with some of this beginning. Amnon, the oldest son, loved his sister Tamar. We spent a moment with that last time, and he loved her so much that it made him sick. His friend Jonadab advised him to play sick, as a matter of fact, so that David would come to visit him and that he would ask David to have this woman, Tamar, Absalom's sister, come and minister to him. And, of course, that worked out just as he had planned. She came, she made the bread and so forth in front of him, and then he asked her to come into this, we'll call it the kind of inner sanctuary, and shut the door. And then, instead of course, being ministered to, he raped her. And then it says that he hated her more than he had loved her before. There's something so sick about this that it's hard even to imagine. But what that meant to her is that her whole life was finished. She would not have a husband. She, I think, by all that you can draw from what was said, would have still married this guy. It seems to me, at least. But now it's obvious that she had been abused, that her life was ruined. And, of course, when she left him, he kicked her out, actually had one of his servants kick her out. This is how much now he hated her. And then, of course, she tore her garments in mourning, and her brother Absalom asked her, "Was Amnon with you?" And, of course, I'm sure the whole story came out, and it just simply says that Absalom didn't say one way or another to his brother, but in his heart, we know he was furious. This sort of seething what would we call it? Visceral rage, I suppose, tore him up inside for 2 years. He knew what he had to do. He knew what was going to happen. And so we really do have this whole prediction by Nathan beginning to happen in the family of David. And I don't know, I think it's about verse 22 there, or something like that, where it says that David himself was angry, very angry, as a matter of fact, about this whole incident. And the very last verse is a very important verse here because it says that after Absalom had taken vengeance on Amnon, the shepherds were shearing the sheep, there was a celebration, the sons of David were called, and how Absalom was able to persuade David that, that this should happen. Anyway, David wouldn't go, but all the sons went, Amnon went. also was requested by Absalom, and then Absalom told his servants, when Amnon has had a little bit too much to drink, why, I'll say slay him, and you slay him. Don't worry about it. I'll take care of everything. I'm the one giving the command here. And you have to wonder, I don't know if we speculated on this or not last time, but you have to wonder whether or not this, in some fashion, wasn't called for by the Torah. There is a passage in Leviticus which suggests that, you know, this kind of thing, a rape, is punishable by death in under certain circumstances. Well, she really had been forced. I mean, it was not willingly on her part that this event occurred. And I wonder if Absalom didn't see himself as the avenger. Somebody had to take vengeance here. David evidently didn't and or wouldn't. This was his oldest son. And he probably was in some kind of exile, but at the same time not really punished. Absalom was going to see to that, which he does here now. The servants do slay Amnon. And then the word goes out to David, all the sons had been killed. But Jonadab, again, this, quotes, friend of Amnon, said the king shouldn't think that all of them, not all his sons, were slain, just one, and that's Amnon. And that's the time at which then Absalom fled through his father-in-law's to where his father-in-law was the ruler. And he was there for 3 years in exile. And then, of course, chapter 14 begins where we have the beginning of now, again, some more awful events in the life of this king. But Absalom is in exile, and we're going to see an interesting event here in chapter 14. David mourned for him. And it just says that he had sort of recovered from the death of Amnon, that last verse. Maybe you could read that in your translation.
Yeah, and the last verse in the ESV of chapter 13 reads, "And the spirit of the king longed to go out to Absalom because he was comforted about Amnon since he was dead."
Yeah. Wasn't anything he could do about it. He was gone, and but he loved Absalom. I don't know if we should speculate at this point about Absalom's position and reputation in the kingdom at this point. It just seems to me that when Joab sends this widow of Tekoa, we'll go into that in a moment, to David to plead in effect for Absalom and Absalom's return, you have to wonder whether or not Joab, although it does say that he saw how David mourned and really desired to have Absalom come back, that somehow or another he also didn't view Absalom as a prospective king. That's the kind of guy Joab was. Well, David's getting old. He can't fulfill all the obligations of a king in this kingdom, and somebody younger needs to take over. I don't know if this is true, but it's just sort of speculation about why he wanted Absalom back. He should have just gone about his own duties. But maybe he did see that David kind of regretted that his son was in exile and that this was a kind of favored son. We'll see later in this chapter that this was a very handsome young man and that his hair was so thick and long that when he pulled it, that is, cut it every year. Well, I don't know if the equivalences are correct here, but it says it weighed what the equivalent was about 5 pounds. That's a lot of hair when he cut his hair. So we'll come to that in a moment. But now then, Joab has something in mind. And of course, I wonder if Absalom himself didn't have the same sort of, I'm sure he did have the same sort of thing in mind. Amnon, son number one, is dead. Chileab the second evidently doesn't play a role here at all. I don't know exactly why, but Absalom, I think, thought of himself as now first in line. Obviously, he's got something in mind. We know that as this whole thing develops. But then we have Joab sending for a widow from Tekoa. Now, I don't know why from Tekoa. I mean, surely there were widows from any place, but she must, it says, a wise woman.
Yeah, same in the ESV.
Yeah, a wise woman. Maybe she had that kind of reputation. Maybe she was an actress of some sort because she did pull this off, and he must have recognized that she could do what needed to be done here, perhaps to persuade the king to bring Absalom back. What I wanted to mention also, although we all know that Solomon is projected as the next king, I don't know that everybody knew that here in the kingdom. I don't know that that was ever announced to anyone. I don't think it is even implied in anything that's said at the birth of Solomon initially, where it says David comforted his wife at the death of that original son that was conceived in the adulterous act. But remember that Nathan came, they called his name Jedidiah, beloved of the Lord. Mm-hmm. But I don't know whether or not people were to draw any conclusion from that, aside from the fact that he was beloved of the Lord, and this was a son that was born to now this relationship with Bathsheba. So it could make sense that Absalom thought of himself as the next in line, and that Joab somehow must have figured something of that sort also. So he wants David to get him back. Then he hires this widow from Tekoa to go to David with this story. Tell him this story. He puts the words in her mouth, is the way King James puts it. I don't know what your translation says.
Yeah, it just says, go to the king and speak thus to him. Oh, so Joab put the words in her mouth. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, put the words in her mouth. In other words, he told her exactly what to say. And you'll be able to pull this off, I'm sure he said to her. Why she's a wise woman, you would think that almost anyone could parrot the words, but this is a woman who could do a good job, and Joab trusted her. So she was willing to do it. She goes to the king, and she begins this story. And I often wonder, when you read this story about these two brothers who were in the field fighting, and the one rose up and slew the other, who would that remind you of?
Yeah, it sounds a lot like Cain and Abel.
Yeah, I wonder if Joab hadn't been reading chapter 4 of Genesis, where Cain slays Abel, his son. And you know, now you'll have to help me with this. What's the verse where it says, she says, I think it's verse 18, I'm not sure, but somewhere there she says that the king is like God himself in making decisions. What is that, verse 16 or verse?
I will find it.
It has to do with how she butters up the king, David. That he is sort of like an angel of the Lord.
That's right. Oh, knowing good and evil, right?
Yeah. It's probably
17. That's right, 17, yeah. And you're sort of, the word of my Lord, the king, will set me at rest. For my Lord, the king, is like the angel of God to discern good and evil.
Yeah, I mean, she really built him up. And I think the people may have thought of him that way. His psalms, all these kinds of things were known of him. And then I think it's repeated in verse 20 then, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken. It says something of the same there.
That's right. My Lord has wisdom like the wisdom of the angel of God to know all things that are on the earth.
Now, that really says something. Yeah. This lady does know how to act. I don't know if Joab gave her all those words. She may have included some of her own to make a point. But she tells about these two sons, and now the relatives, her relatives, want the living son turned over to them because he has slain his brother, and what ought to happen is that he himself ought to give his life because he's taken a life. Well, she comes in and pleads. She says, they're going to take then the burning coal, the only burning coal I have, that is the only life I have in my family, is this son. They want to take that away from me. They want to leave me bereft of a husband and of a child. Well, David says, I'll take care of it, not to worry. She's not satisfied, of course. She really does press him. She wants something done immediately, because if you read through that, you get the impression, look, if this doesn't happen immediately, they could take the life of that son. You could come around afterwards and punish them, but that's not going to help. Mm-hmm. So she keeps pleading. It's sort of like, I guess, Luke 18, where the unjust judge, the widow, kept coming to him. relieve me of my adversary, and this woman's going to wear me out. It's almost like we have a sort of a preliminary to that here, that this lady is going to wear David out, insisting further. She hasn't gotten yet to the point that she wants to make, but she's going to have to reveal what she really wants finally, and that begins in verse 14. Why don't you read 14 through 18, because that chunk of verse 14 especially is revealing. We're getting to the nub of this whole story about that son.
Sure. We must all die. We are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. But God will not take away life, and he devises means so that the banished one will not remain an outcast.
Okay, now you're getting close to what's going on. She's getting at David by building this whole thing to this point where she wants to get to the revelation of why she's here and what ought to happen. But water spilt on the ground is an interesting description because it says can't be gathered up. Once you spill it, you can't bring it back. Mm-hmm. And so it's an interesting way of describing an event that cannot, it's like what... You can't unring the bell, as one of the expressions it's sometimes used. Once it's rung, and you can't unring it. And so if it's spilled on the ground, you can't gather it up again. But keep reading now, verse 15 and 5.
Now I have come to say this to my lord the king, because the people have made me afraid, and your servant thought, I will speak to the king. It may be that the king will perform the request of his servant. For the king will hear and deliver his servant from the hand of the man who would destroy me and my son together from the heritage of God. And your servant thought, the word of my lord the king will set me at rest, for my lord the king is like the angel of God to discern good and evil.
Yeah, so I know who you are, I know what you can do, and I've come under those circumstances. Now, this is a big lie. I mean, she's telling this story. It's a tall tale, but she has a point, and... you know, you sort of excuse or forgive her for doing what she did, because this is probably the best way you could approach David with this problem that Joab had. And I think maybe now if you'll read this further, you'll see that I don't know if we skipped over that or not, where it does say the people of the Lord. It's almost, I know, maybe if you could find that idea.
Sure.
That this is an affront even to the people of the Lord.
Oh, that's right. Back in verse 13, why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in giving this decision, the king convicts himself, inasmuch as the king does not bring his banished one home again.
Okay, that really is revealing. Yeah, you have to look at that. You have to suggest, look, the people somehow are aware of what has gone on, of why... The king himself is so saddened that his daily activities are not as joyful as they had seemed to be. The people have someone perhaps else in mind eventually who will take over, and this will be a peaceful transition. All these kinds of things seem to be embodied in that statement. So the people of the Lord are not uninvolved. So maybe Joab also was hearing these kind of reports. Look, somebody has to take over eventually. David's getting old. He can't remain king forever. We've got to do something about this so that all this is done in an orderly fashion. And then we have those verses at the end. Well, maybe you should read 19 and through verse 19 and 20.
You know, I'm looking at the time, too. Maybe we should take a quick break and then pick it up right there with 19, because that'd be a good maybe transition point.
So. Very good.
All right, we'll be right back after the break.
We'll be back in just a moment to the Concordia Bible Institute podcast. In the meantime, I'd like to have you consider this question. What is most important in higher education? How do you prioritize all the knowledge to be gained at an institution of higher learning? Concordia University, Wisconsin, located on the shores of Lake Michigan in Mequon, Wisconsin, just north of Milwaukee, is an institution that is committed to excellence in learning, but at the same time realizes that excellence in itself is insufficient without development in vocation. We believe that God works through our vocations, our callings, in order to serve the needs of those around us. The mission statement of Concordia University puts it this way: Concordia University, Wisconsin is a Lutheran higher education community committed to helping students develop in mind, body, and spirit for service to Christ in the church and the world. You can learn more about the over 70 programs offered at Concordia by visiting the website, www.cuw.edu. And if you're benefiting from our Christ in Every Word podcasts, I encourage you to support this ministry by mentioning it to others and by offering your monetary support. Please consider supporting the Concordia Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on the contribute page. And now, back to the podcast.
Alrighty there, folks. We are back with our study of 2 Samuel chapter 14. This is the plot, I guess you would say, from Absalom to get back into Jerusalem.
Right, to get Absalom back, and that he eventually, supposedly, will become king. At least that, I think, is in prospect, but it's not going to work out that way naturally. We know it happens, but at the same time, I think this is in the forefront. I think Job's thinking of this, as I indicated, and I think that there are others, the people who are thinking of this.
Right. Well, here's verse 19. This is where David speaks, and he wonders, is the hand of Joab with you in all this? The woman answered and said, as surely as you live, my lord the king, one cannot turn to the right hand or to the left from anything that my lord the king has said. It was your servant Joab who commanded me. It was he who put all these words in the mouth of your servant. In order to change the course of things, your servant Joab did this. But my Lord has wisdom like the wisdom of the angel of God to know all things that are on the earth.
Yeah, that's right. It's interesting there that he, of course, saw through the whole thing eventually. Ah, I see who's behind this. This widow didn't just show up and talk about, in verse 13, what she had talked about. Doesn't the king bring an exiled person back? Wonder if he didn't think. She's talking about Absalom. Well, obviously, eventually, this all came out, and she's exposed, and then she says it's Joab, and then David says, okay, have Joab get him back. And so Joab comes in, of course, tells the king this whole story that Absalom needs to come back. The king needs to have him back, And so David says, all right, bring him back. But he's not going to see the king's face, which means that he's not in full favor yet with David. Even though he's back in the kingdom, he will have a sort of free reign, but not entirely. And he won't until he can come before the king and, in a sense, be forgiven, in a sense, be relieved of the responsibility of having taken the life of his brother. And at that point, then, perhaps he can do almost as he wants to do. So there we have him. He's back in the kingdom, but he's not going to see the king's face. What is it, for 2 years?
That's right. I thought that was the case. I thought I saw it.
Anyway, if it's not two, it's three. But nevertheless, for a period of time, he still can't see the king's face. Then it describes Absalom a little bit. Verse 25, where it tells a little bit about Absalom.
That's right. It was two full years, and Absalom's being described right before that. So, yes, that's right. It does spend a lot of time talking about Absalom, doesn't it?
It gives this.
In all Israel, there is not so much, no one so much to be praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. And when he cut the hair of his head, for at the end of every year he used to cut it, when it was heavy on him, he cut it. He weighed the hair of his head. Who does that, by the way?
You don't unless you got a whole bunch.
200 shekels by the king's weight. They were born to Absalom three sons and one daughter whose name was Tamar. She was a beautiful woman.
Yeah, that's interesting also. He has a daughter by the name of Tamar. Woman, almost like, all right, to replace the one who was in disgrace. It's interesting. Now I want you to turn to 2 Samuel chapter 18 and read verse 18.
2 Samuel 18, verse 18. I think I know what you're getting at with this, and that is, now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself the pillar that is in the king's valley, for he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. He called the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's monument to this day. It sounded like he had three sons here.
And there it says none. Now, how do you explain the difference? And my explanation has always been they probably died. In other words, anything could have happened under these circumstances. And He had gone, you know how he moved around. He had gone to Geshur, came back, and all this kind of movement with these children, all kinds of things could have happened. I don't know any other answer to give you beyond the fact that if he didn't have sons at this point, there's a reason for that. It doesn't say about the daughter, see, so it just says that he didn't have any sons, and so he puts up a monument to himself. Mm-hmm. How to explain beyond that, I don't know. I don't know. You have an explanation.
No, I was
just sense.
I was looking at the study note while you said that, and it's the same thing. Perhaps they died prematurely.
Oh, what does it say about the amount of hair? Does it give you in pounds?
It says in shekels here in the ESV, yeah. 200 shekels, and then it just has the footnote that a shekel was about 11 grams. I didn't know how much
that's
math
helpful.
We're going to do with this podcast.
Very, very helpful, yes, 11 grams.
11 grams.
One shekel? So how many grams that would be is a bunch.
I don't
know. But the one I looked up said 5 pounds. I thought, boy, that's really heavy because I had a weight initially way back when I used to lift weights. I had a weight for each arm, 5 pounds. And I thought, boy, that's pretty heavy for hair.
Oh, man, that's a lot of hair.
Yeah.
That's a lot of hair.
So this guy must really have been handsome, man. And it's interesting, that will be his downfall. The beauty of his hair,
right.
This is going to be his downfall eventually.
Right.
So it's interesting how the Lord, it's sort of ironic that I'm sure he must have taken great pleasure in the fact that he had this hair, that he cropped it, and he had that much. And probably gave him a lot of personal pleasure and prestige, and that would be what is responsible eventually for his death.
It's kind of interesting how David says, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground.
Yes.
Well.
One hair. I got a son with lots of it, so one wouldn't make too much difference.
Right.
Anyway,
yeah.
So then we'll go on and find out, all right, now things are going to happen. He really does have an idea of the kingdom. He wants to be king, and he's going to effect that and accomplish it. But he's got to be, of course, in the good graces of the king. So he wants to see the king. He sends for Joab, and Joab doesn't come. Sends for Joab a second time. Joab doesn't come. How can I get in touch with him? You know, I can't confront him. So he says to his servants, burn his barley fields. Let's see if that won't bring him. Well, the servants carry out his command, and Joab comes running. What's going on here? Why do your servants burn my fields? Well, I called you twice. You didn't come. So now Joab is instructed, I got to see the king's face. I might just as well have stayed in Geshur in exile. And if I die, I die. But I want to see the king, and I want to be in the king's good graces because I got things I've got to do. Well, it happens. David lets him come before him. They embrace. And Absalom is in the king's good graces. He's ready to roll. He's ready, really, to take charge. And he is so devious because he really, who knows, he really had taken the life deliberately of his brother. Whether the brother deserved it or not is not the question. He had done this. And now all of a sudden he's been, quotes, forgiven it all. Forgiven it all. And you think, well, he'd be eternally grateful. Not so. He's got other plans. And it starts in the next chapter. Chapter 15 is most interesting because this deviousness of the man is just almost beyond comprehension. What he would plan against his father to wrest the kingdom. Lord, keep us steadfast in his word. Isn't that the hymn?
That's right.
To wrest the kingdom from his son,
that's right.
Who fain would rescue the kingdom from his son, that he would try to do this in such a devious way staggers the imagination to do justice to it. But it's going to happen. So this is what he's got in mind. And he's got to make plans, and he's got to kind of carry them out gradually. So what does he do? He has 50 men. They run in front of him, and they announce his coming. And he's making a big splash to all the people. Absalom is back. It's sort of like a great athlete. I'm back.
Yeah, that's right.
Or like Schwarzenegger. I'm back.
That's great.
Yeah, I'm back. Anyway, he's back.
That's That's right.
And he's not going to let the people forget it. So he has these people run in front of him. They announce his arrival, and this goes on for a while. He goes to the gate. This is maybe we are we about done?
Well, I was just looking at the time, and I'm thinking with about a minute left, we should probably start chapter 15 next time.
But yeah,
I suppose that does bring 14 to a close, doesn't it? In terms of Absalom is finally reunited with the king. Although I was wondering about the fact that. They didn't really, there was no words exchanged.
No.
There was no, the forgiveness or none of that.
None of that.
There's no dialogue, just the king kissed Absalom and that's that. So outwardly, at least I was just reading the footnote too. It looked like it was more of an outward thing, but their hearts were far apart.
So that the people would know at least that he's in the king's good graces. He has, in a sense, permission to do what he's going to do, what he already had in mind, and that the people would not resent it. After knowing what he had done with the murder of his brother. So that does bring it to a conclusion, but I don't know whether or not we should try to dig deeper into the relationship between David and Absalom. But
Absalom,
he still loved Absalom.
Right.
Absalom, I guess, still was one of his favorites. He had lots of sons, of course. We don't know exactly how many, and we know that they were on mules, that they ran out of that celebration, but we don't know how many and who they were and what they were like. This is the one we do know. And he's accorded, I guess, a full, quote, citizenship again by David. And that's the end of the account at that point, but not the end of Absalom.
Right.
And we know he loved him because at the end,
that
chapter, Absalom, my dear son, my son Absalom, would God I had died for you. Well, end it with that because what David couldn't do for his son, we're going to find out that David's son would be able to do for David and everybody else. The father was willing to agree to this.
Well, I think that's a good place to stop for this episode. But thanks again, Dr. Sleska, for your Christ-centered reflections here.
My pleasure.
And tune in next time when we talk about what Absalom's
we'll talk about that son.
Conspiracy is all about. And yes, we'll talk about that son. We'll also talk about great David's greater son as well.
Yes, always.
That's right.
It's all, in a sense, leading toward him. And David, of course, not capable of shadowing very clearly what his greater son would be like. But nevertheless, he does provide for us shadows here and there, types, figures in the Old Testament, which lead us to understand him as the Messianic King.
Well, thanks again for that, Dr. Sleska, and for you for tuning in. Please tell your family and friends that they, too, can learn more about God's Word with us. The mission of the Concordia Bible Institute is to provide Christ-centered Bible instruction from distinguished experts who teach Christ in every word of the Old and New Testaments to strengthen faith and spread belief in the one true God. Again, if you benefit from this podcast series, I encourage you to consider supporting the Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on our contribute page. Until next time, I'm Dr. Brian Gurman here today with Dr. John Sleska, wishing you God's blessings in Christ Jesus our Lord.